session number 11952, row 7.
Mr. Roselle, Rule 7.
I was asking you if before the attack on the 7th of July on the Somme, you had been briefed about what was happening in general and what you were going to be doing.
I remember being told that we hadn't to bother about contact on left or right. We were to go to our objective. Never mind whether we weren't in contact with left or right, which we did. And other than that, we were just told that we were going over in lines, and we were to occupy the French, the trench, of course, and deal with the Germans if they were there, and so on.
Who actually did that briefing?
The major. One of the company captains, I call them, but one of them was a major. We had one major, three captains, and the rest were lieutenants and subalterns.
When he did the briefing, did he just do it verbally, or did he have maps or other visual aids to show you what was going on?
No, he had a barn door and some chalk. And he just sketched out, these are the German trenches, 700 yards to go. It's flat, and there's the... By the way, of course, we were going over where the 1st of July had been over and had failed. That's a question I've asked myself. Why was it there were two attacks and yet the wire was still intact at O'Villers? It must have been that either a dip in the ground so that the trajectory of the shells missed it or something, but the wire was absolutely intact. There was no possibility of getting through.
Was it absolutely flat where you attacked?
Oh, well, yes, we just walked, walked over the shell holes and everything else, but it was flat, the land, and there was the ridge at the back. Because a couple of days after, when we came out, I was sent back again with five or six men to collect the pay books of our men. And the Germans had been pushed over the ridge so that we could go up in daylight.
You were in dead ground then?
Yes. And, of course, we had to turn. They were all our own men. Some were from the attack that had happened on the 1st. We had to turn them over and to get to their breast pockets where they always kept their pay book. We collected them in sandbags. And of course we were face to face with the absolute horror war. Men decapitated, empty brain cavities, entrails where they'd been sort of disemboweled. Everything was horrible, really. In fact, that day at O'Villers, getting the pay books from our own men, that's absolutely engraved on my brain. I've thought about it all during my life,
Was that odd the moments. Worst thing that happened to you?
Yes, because we... Normally, in the trench, if a man was wounded, you yelled for the stretcher bearers. If they took him away, that was that, you see. But here we had all our men mangled. There was a corpse every odd yard, halfway up the 700 yards, because very few got past that because they were being mown down by machine gun fire. How the dickens some escape, I've never known. I did hear a farmer once said to me, we were talking about survivors, he said, well, in those days, of course, the reaper on a farm was horse-drawn. And he said, well, one explanation, he said that you can reap a field all over, you think you've done it and yet here and there there's a stalk still standing. There was another explanation, I don't know what I think of this, but a Frenchman said to me once about surviving, he said, Le bon Dieu, il a dit, cette man ne tue pas. So, anyway, I'm here.
You're one of the lucky ones.
Yes, yes.
When you got into the German trench with the Middlesex Regiment, or whoever they were, what condition was it in?
It was in fairly good condition. Fairly good condition.
Hadn't been collapsed then?
No, no. But the Germans had left by then, you see.
Had they taken all their casualties with them?
No, we had wounded Germans in the trench, and unfortunately they had to stay there because our stretcher bearers were so busy that they took our own men first, naturally. But our men were kind to them. They gave them water, cigarettes, and depends how badly they were wounded. We tried to tie them up or put a tourniquet on. But that was when it quietened down, you know, because in the beginning, of course, all this time, I'm talking about machine gun fire, but of course the Germans were shelling as well. They immediately opened out.
Did you have much training in first aid? Had you been taught?
No, none at all. I've often thought of that because years afterwards I went through a course with the firm that I was with, and I realised how important it was to know the pressure points to stop arterial bleeding. Now, we could, just with that knowledge alone, we could have saved dozens, I should think, because I remember men were wounded, especially through the thigh, you know, and bleeding. You'd think, oh, well, he's got a... no bones broken, he's got a jemmy one, you know, he'd get the blighty. A few hours afterwards, he was dead.
Because he just bled to death.
I remember a fellow shot through the neck, and we bound him up. We didn't know anything about it. He died just the same. Lieutenant Schell, one of our first casualties, he was wounded at in front of Armentières when we were brand new, you know, early on. He was shot through the thigh and taken away, and we thought, oh, that's okay, he'll be all right. Came back, he died. Obviously, it was a femoral artery. We didn't know that. Now, had we known something like that, but we were never taught that sort of thing.
You never had any instruction in first aid?
None at all.
Through the war?
No. We just bound. And you see, we only had a bandage that was fit for a bullet wound. You know, a little pad. If you've got a shrapnel wound or a shell took a slice out of you, we had nothing, really.
What demeanour did the Germans have when you found them in the trench?
Well, they were sort of neutral. Some of them were a bit surly, and we had one case later on. This was on the Somme, just the same, but a month after, when we attacked again, one of them spat in one of our fellows' faces, and of course he got assaulted back. But generally they were sort of just smiling and taking a cigarette and so on. But in the case I'm talking about later on the Somme, we got into the German trench, and with a travelling barrage this time, so they were taking cover when we got there. They all surrendered, and there were as many Germans as Englishmen. But we made sure they were disarmed, and then we couldn't get rid of them because we had no trench going back. So, and when we tried to drive them back over the top, they didn't want to go because they were...
their own artillery would have been...
I remember that, yeah. But usually they were glad to surrender, I know, because they were on the Somme, and I expect they'd had several weeks of it, bombarding and whatnot, and they were... I suppose they thought they were out of the war.
Do you remember what sort of troops they were? Do you know where they were from in Germany?
No. we were asked, when I was a sniper, if ever we got a position where we could see into their lines, we were told not to use it as a sniping point, but as an observation point, and send back to battalion headquarters, who would send it back to brigade, if we could read or their cap badges or their dress, so that they could tell which regiment it was. But we were more or less uninterested in that. We just knew they were Germans.
Do you remember what you thought about their uniform and equipment when you saw them in this
trench? Well, we always thought that their jackboots were better than our putties, because as soon as you got them wet, they tightened on your legs and they were most uncomfortable, and they remained wet for ages. Whereas they, at least, their jackboots came up to their knee, you see. And we thought we could have been better shod in the line with those, but anyway.
Did you ever get issued with rubber boots or anything of that sort?
Yes, we were issued with them. I only remember on one occasion, and after that they were scrapped, because once you've put those on, your feet are always wet, and they're wet forever, and people were beginning to get sort of trench feet with the wet. And another thing, when the mud began to dry and began to act as a suction, you were pulling your your rubber boots off. You really wanted thigh boots that were fastened.
Waders would have been the best thing.
Yes, something like that.
What about the rest of the German uniform and their rifles and so forth? What did you think of those?
Well, we tried using their rifles if we could find ammunition, and it looked as though they were very similar in calibre, and they were somewhere near 303 like ours, and they were the same type of bullet, so plated lead inside and plated outside. But we found that when they attacked, or when they were in fighting order, they didn't have a pack. They had a sort of haversack on their back. So they were much more mobile than we were. We were like, as our people used to say, we were like pack mules, and going over the top. Whereas they were in what they called their fighting order, much lighter. But we always went equipped to stay with everything with us, you see.
Had to have the material with which to consolidate.
Yes. Whereas the Germans, they were in a foreign country, and I think that's why they made such deep dugouts, so they were determined to stay there. But we wanted to push them out, of course.
You mentioned you got a good, it sounds like you got a good general briefing at on the Somme. Had you had a similar sort of detailed briefing when you were at Loos?
No, we didn't know. At Loos, we marched and arrived late at night to relieve the guards. I don't know which guards, the guards were there, and as soon as we got to relieve them, they disappeared. They'd had enough. And we had a trench about that deep in the chalk, and we knew that the Germans were out there somewhere, but where, we didn't know until daylight, you see. And that was the only place I ever saw the Germans counterattack in force 2 days after. And we had a couple of Vickers guns, and they were coming to us, and we were firing at them, but they still came on, because it was obviously a company or a battalion of Germans. And then our machine guns opened out from each end of our position, and that stopped it.
So the machine guns were crossing their fire,
yes,
were they?
Yes, they did that. That's what was happening at O'Villas. They were firing from a long way away, some of them, and cross-firing, obviously, because I remember when I was going, before I got on the where the road was, I remember seeing the earth going like this, you know,
What, shaking?
Really? Yeah, and I realised it was the end of a machine gun. It had come to Earth, you know.
Just
might have been spent, but it was enough to go. There weren't any bullets visible, so it would have gone through my feet, you know, and through my body. And I remember thinking, that's a machine gun. Things you think of. And I sort of walk round it, as it were. But that's an actual fact. I remember that plainly.
So it sounds like you came to the place where they've got a sort of beaten zone.
Yes. And I'd tell another thing at Old Villas too. After it was all over, my rifle had a bullet hole through the butt. Absolutely at right angles. Well, I was carrying it this way. So
carrying it at the trail then?
Yes. Obviously, they were halfway to their line. They were enfilading us, you see, because there were a slight bridge all the way around there. In fact, they call that, it's the troops that call it, there are two valleys. There's one at Old Villas and one next door. And they called one Mesh Valley and one Sausage Valley. I don't know which was which of ours. But it was a slight valley and there was a ridge along all round. And they were obviously firing from there too, you see.
So you were really under observation, weren't you?
Yes.
From the beginning.
Well, as I say, as soon as we got out of the trench, and I tell you another thing, see, we didn't, on the Somme, we didn't have a travelling barrage. We bombarded for so many days and nights, and we were proud to say how many tons of shells we dropped, and they told us there'd be nobody there, they couldn't possibly live, it would be a walkover. Well, then, you see, they were in their deep dugouts. As soon as the zero hour came, we lifted our barrels to the back areas to prevent reinforcements coming up. And then we went over. Well, we had 700 yards to go. They came out of their deep dugouts, set up their machine guns. By the time we were just a few yards out of our trench, they were opening fire. That's what happened on the Somme. And I think, my own private opinion, that those casualties, three quarters of them were machine gun fire, and it all happened in the first quarter of an hour.
What happened then in your second attack on the Somme? Where did that go in?
That was successful. It was a night attack. We had about 300, 400 yards to go, and we crept out after dark and laid down about 100 yards in front of our trench. We had no artillery bombardment, but we had about a 5-minute mortar bombardment, and when the mortar stopped we were to go. That is what we did, and we jumped in the trench, as I tell you, full of Germans, and they all surrendered. And the next day in daylight, one of our fellows crept out the back looking for some firewood or something to drum up, you know, that's the sort of thing he did, risking his life, but he wanted some tea. And somebody else looking out the back yelled to him, "Look behind you!" And there was a German behind him. And then they all came up, there were about 50 Germans.
With their hands up.
Yes, they definitely, when our barrage started, they'd been told to go out in front, which they'd done, and in the dark we'd pass them in the shell holes, and in the morning, so we had more prisoners coming in that time.
Who did this attack? Was this your battalion reconstituted and filled up with?
Yes, well, after Old Villas, we went back, as I say, to some huts in a wood behind Elbert, and I always call it Buzzwoods. It might have been an army name because it had a board up with Buzzwoods, whether it was our, or that was the place. I'd never been able to find it on a French map anyway. And a battalion came to us, intact, a colonel, an adjutant, four captains, and sergeants, the lot, you know. So they were a complete battalion. That was our draft, as we called it, but we were being attached to them. And the new colonel was Elliot Cooper, and he got a VC, posthumously years after at Arras.
What sort of impression did they make on you, this draft who came up?
Well, we knew that they were, compared to us, they were just new in the army. Some people had been wounded, sent to England, and they'd been sent out again, so you had occasional older, more experienced people. But in the main, they were, but it was a good battalion, we just joined in with them. And when the Elliot Cooper discovered that we went in the line after O'Villas for an ordinary stretch. We didn't go over the top or anything. We stayed there 2 or 3 days. And we were on a ridge. And so I expect that's why he chose me. I don't know. It was all the battalion to choose from. But anyway, I got it sent to me. As I say, I had... Is this recording? Oh. I had the instruction, written instruction from him for years and years and years, and unfortunately I haven't got it any longer. But his instruction was to take the dummy periscopes, under cover of the darkness, enter the old German trench, and stick the periscopes up as you would do with normal periscopes, and remain there, get back the following night and report to him. This is what we did, of course, in the morning, thinking the trench was reoccupied. The Germans plastered it with every sort of mortar and shell and grenade, but we kept moving along to where the trench was undamaged, and by the time darkness fell, we still hadn't had any casualties. We returned to our own trench and reported. As far as I could see, the only thing was we'd made the enemy waste some ammunition.
It sounds as though this Colonel Elliot Cooper was a man with some imagination.
Oh, yes. I tell you, of course, I was wounded the next night, wasn't I? Yes, we're going to say it's not reporting now, is it? Oh, yes. The next night, no, actually, this was the spell we had in the trenches in between O'Villas and Pozières.
That's right.
Pozières, that was a night attack. Well, I've already recorded that, haven't I? We went over at night.
We laid down to no man's land.
That's right.
At night.
Have we recorded that? Oh. Anyway, we went out. There was about 400 yards to go, 300 or 400 yards to go to their trench. And because of the attacks that had gone before, there was no wire. We knew there was no wire between us and the Germans. And we laid out under cover of darkness about 100 yards in front of our front line. And there was a short 5 minutes or so of mortar barrage, no artillery barrage. And when the mortar barrage ended, we were to advance. We did, and jumped into the trench, which was full of Germans. They were sheltering from the bombardment of our mortars. And we were all armed, and they immediately surrendered. There were as many Germans in the trench as there were British soldiers. It was a bit embarrassing for a bit, but they were gradually ushered away and forced to go back over no man's land. The next night, we were still in their trench, which had been a German trench, and of course they knew the range to a yard, and they began a terrific bombardment, which went on hour after hour. Anyway, about 2 in the morning, when the bombardment had been on for a couple of hours or more, a sergeant asked me to see how many men we had left in our platoon, because we were getting casualties all the time. the trench was no longer a trench, it was just a series of shell holes. I went along where the trench had been, and I found an odd man here and an odd man there. I remember I went back to him and I wrote a little chit saying that we had, I think it was 6 men in our platoon. He was sitting at a T-junction with the communicating trench, and at that point the trench was in rather good condition. So I sat next to him on the floor, gave him the chit and was talking to him when there was an explosion quite near, and I felt my helmet go and I realised that I was wounded. I scrambled over a heap of soil which was in front of me, evidently blown up by the shell, and as I scrambled across it I felt it moving. There were evidently people buried underneath who were struggling to get out. A few more yards along the communicating trench, I realised where I was. I suppose I'd recovered from the blow, and I realised that if I kept to the communicating trench I'd have about a mile to go, whereas there was a road nearby which went direct towards Elbear. So I climbed up onto the road and walked as fast as I could until I came to the glow of a cigarette burning on the side of the road. I said to the fellow who's smoking, "Can you tell me where there's a dressing station?" And he pulled back a blanket that had been screening a little dugout in the bank of the road. He was a RAMC man. Inside there were a couple of stretchers with some wounded men on them. He sat me on a box and fumbled with my breast tunic buttons. I said, "Oh, it's not there, it's my face, my jaw." And he said, "Yes, okay," and still went on. But what he was doing was giving me an anti-tetanus injection in the chest, because they'd found out in France that so many wounds were getting tetanus, the soil was infected quite heavily with tetanus germs. I remember saying to him, "Is this a blighty one?" And he said, "My lad, this time next week, you'll be sitting in a deck chair drinking ice drinks through a straw." He was right. I went eventually to Liverpool.
How did you get back then from that advanced dressing station?
Where I was got the tetanus injection.
Yeah, how did you get back from there?
Oh, he said sooner or later there'll be an ambulance come up here and take you back. And so he said we have to wait because we don't know whether they arrive or when they'll arrive, but they should be. Anyway, after a bit one came, and we went, and he loaded the stretcher men in, and I sat in the sitting place at the end of the, just inside the back door, and off we went, and we stopped at Crucifix Corner, where an MO came out, doctor, flashed his torch around, and he said to me, "You'd better get out," and I knew that it was because of the blood on my tunic, but it wasn't, that was just coming from my jaw. I said to him, being anxious to get away from the, as far as possible from the war, I said, "No, I'm all right." He said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yes." So he said to the driver, "Away you go, driver." And as we drove away, occasionally leaving the road to get round big shell holes in the road, but eventually we got further back where there were no shell holes, and we began to make smooth progress. And I remember feeling how glad I was that I was getting further and further away from the noise and the horror of the war. We came to a marquee in a field, and for the rest of the night we were put on stretchers after a cursory glance at our wounds by the doctor, who thought we could be okay for the night and would be seen to in the morning. in the morning, quite a few of the people had died during the night and were carted away out of the pavilion. And then a hospital train drew up alongside the field, and some of the troops took the railings down and they loaded the train with the wounded that were all in the pavilion. And we eventually arrived at Etarp. I was lucky enough to be directed to a Canadian hospital where we were stripped of our lousy uniforms, had a bath, and heavenly, we were in a bed with sheets, no lice, absolute peace.
Why was the Canadian hospital so favoured?